Conference record has joined the conference.
Long-term care nails, right?
Oh, you're calling into over here? So we'll have it over there and over here. Yeah. Look, I'm okay. I got my jib sheet. Come on out to the hand.
Hello?
Hello? Hello?
Hi, is this the MRT work group?
This is Pat Rowan. I'm supposed to be speaking at the work group.
Pat, it's Meg Wallingford from Senior Whole Health.
Meg, how are you?
Good. I keep hearing them kind of pop in and pop out.
Yeah, I think we may be on mute at their end.
Okay.
The leader has muted your line. To unmute your line, press #6.
Simone from St. Nicholas.
Good morning. This is Francis from Union Settlement.
Hi. Hello. Hi, this is Simone, the DPS from St. Nicholas.
Hi, this is Frances Sadler from Union Settlement.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Are we the only ones on yet?
Hi. Good morning. Suffolk County is on also.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
They haven't started yet, I guess. They started. They're probably just getting in now.
Okay. We're here.
This is a Medicaid redesign team call. Please stand by. We'll be starting shortly.
Good morning. We are going to begin our Medicaid redesign team meeting on the managed long-term care implementation and waiver redesign. And this is our first meeting, and I want to welcome everyone. And just a couple of rules. Unfortunately, we can't accommodate all the people who want to participate, so we do have a dial-in number for the public, which can accommodate up to 300 people at a time who can listen to the meeting. So I'm going to ask the members of our work group, when they speak, to first of all be sure to use your microphone, because this is being recorded and it will be available on the website, and to also identify yourself so those who are on the phone will know who is speaking. So let me just introduce myself and then turn it over to my co-chair. I'm Carol Raphael, the president and CEO of the Visiting Nurse Service of New York.
I'm Eli Feldman. I'm president and CEO of MJHS, and I'm chair of CCLC.
And we wanted to begin by going around the room and asking each of the work group members to just identify who you are and your connection to the whole long-term care system in New York State. So, Mark, I think
I'm Mark Messenger, and I'm one of the staff leads on this work group on the Deputy Commissioner's Office of Long-Term Care Department of Health.
I'm Jim Intron. I'm a member of the Medicare redesign team and staff of Health.
I'm Michael Birnbaum, Vice President of the United Hospital Fund and Director of the Fund Medicaid.
Joe Healy, Chief Operating Officer for Comprehensive Care Manager.
I'm Kate Rolfman.
I'm Dr. Callahan, I'm the New York State Policy Director for the Medicare Rights
Joanne
Costantino,
I'm CEO of
the
Eddy, which is a network of senior services in
the
capital region of the city.
I'm Marilyn Stabio, I'm the director of the Advocate Care Center and
Kevin Finnegan, I'm the political director of 1199 SEIU. I'm in for George Gresham. I'll be sitting here in this committee for him. We represent about 150,000 workers delivering long-term care in the state of New York.
Okay. I'm Kathy Shore, Senior Vice President for Managed Care with the Greater New York Hospital Association.
Okay. Valencia, before you depart, we just wanted to have you introduce yourself.
Sorry. I'm Valencia Lloyd from the Division of Managed Care.
So all members of our work group are present except for Tom Holt, who had something that prevented him from joining us today, and he's the president and CEO of Lutheran Social Services, I believe, in Jamestown, New York. We just wanted to review something which I believe all of you have received and is also in your packet, which is the work group charge and deliverables. We are supposed to be advising the Department of Health on the development of care coordination models, which may include the long-term home health care programs to be used in the mandatory enrollment of people who will be in need of community-based long-term care services. We're supposed to really focus on implementation, which is often the hardest part, and what we need to do to ensure that there is sufficient capacity, availability, accessibility, and continuity of services. And lastly, we really want to make sure that we don't lose focus on ways to continue to promote the ability of people to get services and support at home in communities and avoid nursing home placements and hospital stays that are unnecessary. So that's kind of our broad charge. We will be reporting to the full Medicaid redesign team on November 1st. So we have a very, very short time frame at this point. We have two more meetings that have been scheduled on August 16th at the Department of Health Capital Regional Office in Troy and on September 20th at this same location. But it is entirely possible that we will need to have calls or other meetings or subgroups that are working during this next few months in addition to the meetings that we've already scheduled. But we certainly have an ambitious agenda and a very short time frame.
Question, please.
Sure.
It was my understanding that
Did you press
Betty, can you just press your button and just identify yourself? And I'm going to be annoying, so please forgive me.
Betty Mullen, DeProza. Question, as I had heard from other sources, and obviously have not been intimately involved in the whole redesign team, that the care coordination models were not limited to long-term home health care, but did include medical adult day. Is that correct?
All care coordination models are on the table for discussion, and we'll be considering long-term home health care was only an example that was put in, but certainly to the extent that we focus on care coordination models, it can be considered.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions at this point from work group members? Can you identify yourself?
I'm Lane. You have to press the
right.
My name is Mark Lane, Fidelis Care, New York.
Welcome.
Hi, Eli.
So I wanted to spend a moment on what we're going to do today. I think our main goal is to educate work group members and lay the foundation for our work. So we're going to spend some time looking at our current managed care and long-term care service system in New York State. We will also take a look at the target populations that we serve, and we're going to hear about what we can learn from other states, what they have engaged in, and in particular, their initiatives around trying to better serve the dual eligible population. So that is our main element in today's agenda. We will ensure that you have time to ask questions of all of the speakers, and we will move on from there to try to frame the key policy questions that we will need to address as a work group.
Excuse me, Carol.
Sure, Marilyn.
I can't turn it on, so.
Okay.
When you talk about the rules, you know, you really also have to remember that people with physical disabilities are also not
duly eligible. Half of our membership is not because of worker histories, or they're usually recipients of SSI and therefore don't have Medicare. So long-term care has to look at that as well.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Any other comments before we launch? Oh, the first part of our agenda is the overview of current managed care and long-term care services in New York State, and Valencia Lloyd and Mark Kissinger are going to review that with us. Take it away.
Good morning. Thank you, Carol. We wanted to give you a level set for the discussion for today and the subsequent meeting. And so we thought it would be a good idea to give you a feel of what currently exists in the area of managed long-term care and the other waiver programs, and also some of the new initiatives that have come about through the most recent legislative session. So initially, the presentation will go over the current managed long-term care plans and the waiver programs, delineation of those plans, and the populations that they serve. We will talk about some of the major changes that are affecting both Medicaid managed care, which is our mainstream program, and the managed long-term care program. Also look at changes that will happen in the local districts relating to the administration of this program, mandatory enrollment of long-term care users in April 2012, and talk about a statutory framework that exists currently for care coordination models, which we know that there is additional development that will occur for those, and a brief overview of the recently awarded dual planning grant that we received from CMS. And lastly, there will be an overview of the long-term care waivers and major community-based long-term care services. In addition to those things, there will be additional information, data provided by Pat Ruhan, who is on the phone, who will talk about some of the data and specific things pertaining to the populations that are targeted for mandatory enrollment in April 2012. So initially, in New York State, we have three current models of managed long-term care, and that is the PACE program. Let me start with the partially capitated managed long-term care plans. The partial capitated plans are capitated for some Medicaid services. The benefit package is home care, personal care, other long-term care services, and also dental vision, nursing home services, and transportation. The primary and acute care services are paid fee-for-services by Medicare for the dual population and Medicaid for the non-dual population. We have 13 plans in the state offering this product, and the current enrollment as of May 2011 was about 30,000 members. The range of enrollment goes from 161 members enrolled in plans to about 9,000 enrolled in plans. Prior to this initiative, New York State had a moratorium on the development of additional partials because we wanted to enroll individuals and promote the integrated program. But more recently, there was a change, and we are now allowing the development of additional partials throughout the state and are promoting those programs. The next program that we have is the PACE program, which is the program for all-inclusive care for the elderly. It's a federal program that integrates Medicare and Medicaid services. There is one capitated rate for both. We work closely with CMS for those. They cover all services, clinic and day center services, and they also have relatively small networks available for their members because they're customized around their members. The benefit package, as I indicated, includes the complete continuum of care, primary acute and long-term care. We currently have 7 plans, and there is an enrollment of about 3,600 people in the state. We do have 2 new PACE plans that are currently under development now. Our integrated model is the Medicaid Advantage Plus plan. It is also a capitated integrated program for Medicare and Medicaid. Requires the person to be a dual in order to enroll. They provide, again, integrated services, primary, acute, and long-term care services. And we currently have 8 plans throughout the state, and the enrollment is about 1,300 individuals, 1,400. In managed care, in our mainstream program, which is our Medicaid managed care program, there is about 3.4 million individuals enrolled. You have to be a non-dual in order to enroll in the mainstream Medicaid managed care program. And for the managed long-term care program, they currently are able to enroll both duals and non-duals. In the future, the target for our discussion is primarily dealing with the dual population. However, there are some non-duals that will be targeted for enrollment. And, you know, we continue to get confused on the state initiatives with non-duals and duals. For the non-duals, we are looking to enroll them in our mainstream program. However, there is special consideration being given to the adult disabled population. We also have looked at the reason that we're enrolling the non-dual population into the mainstream program is because the state is responsible for all services provided to those individuals. And so it's better to enroll them in an integrated comprehensive program where there's a capitation rate that is predictable that will cover the full array of services. Some of the initiatives that have affected both the Medicaid Managed Care Mainstream Program and the Managed Long-Term Care Program are some changes that are coming forward, benefit changes. There are personal care, for example, will be moving into the mainstream benefit package in August 2011. The recipient restriction program, which is currently a program that individuals who have been identified to overutilize services and cannot explain why there is overutilization or fraud or abuse, have been placed in the state recipient restriction program. If you currently are in the recipient restriction program, you were not allowed to enroll in the mainstream program nor the managed long-term care program. We are now enrolling that population as of August 1st. September 2011, there were some changes made to the role that the local districts will play in the managed long-term care enrollment. And I'll speak more to those things as we go through. And lastly, in October 2011, pharmacy will be added into the mainstream benefit package. Currently, pharmacy is fee-for-service. So in looking at those initiatives, with bringing personal care into the mainstream benefit package, PERS, which is the Personal Emergency Response System, will be coming in January 2012. All of the services will be in plan. So we are hoping by the end of January, all services relating to the provision of personal care for the non-dual population will be covered in Medicaid managed care programs. In April 2012 is a major initiative, and it begins on mandatory enrollment of dual eligibles who require community-based long-term care services over 120 days into a managed long-term care plan or a care coordination model, which is yet to be defined. In July 2012, we have on our schedule that consumer-directed personal assistance program will be enrolled in the managed long-term care and the Medicaid managed care program. And one of the initiatives that we have to do is to talk more about what is needed in order to have a smooth transition for those populations to come in and whether they should actually come in July 2012. And lastly, in October 2012, nursing home placement becomes a benefit in the mainstream Medicaid managed care program. So individuals who are non-dual residing in the nursing home will be required to enroll in the mainstream program. Again, these are some benefit changes that happened to the Medicaid program in general. There were some changes to prescription footwear. It's limited to shoe attached to the lower limb, brace, or a component of a diabetic treatment. Compression stockings were limited to the treatment for open venous stasis ulcers. Enteral formula, effective May 1st, will be limited to those who cannot obtain nutrition through other means or tube feeding. And in October 1st, 2011, there will be changes to physical therapy and occupational therapy and speech therapy. And there will be limited, the premiums for plans will have these limitations. However, there is flexibility provided within the plan for them to provide services that will promote better outcomes for the population. And in October 1st, which I can't speak that much to, but there are changes for the MAP program, which is our integrated program, that the RAP for Part D drugs would be eliminated.
Okay, Valencia, why don't we just stop here, because that's a lot to digest, and I see there are some questions at this point. So, Dave.
I just have a logistical question. Are these the slides that are currently on the website? Because I was still having trouble last night seeing the correct link to the website.
Yeah, it's supposed to be up.
Are there any hard copies available for any of these people for today? Or?
We have a couple packets that we're going to show up.
Okay, yeah. We would request that they go to the website to get the information.
Okay, Carol.
Thank you. I have a question about the this slide that's up there right now. Because you said there's flexibility within the plans. Could you be more specific about that? For example, since you're paying on a per member per month basis, the plans are allowed to go over and above the 20 visits for PT if it's necessary to keep the members stable and functioning?
That is how we would like to implement this benefit. The premium will be based upon the limitations that you do see. However, we do want to afford flexibility to plans if they feel providing additional PT or OT would improve an outcome. However, we are working with OMIG to make sure that that is something that is acceptable. But that is how we would like to move forward.
Marilyn. I'm going to just, Marilyn Saviola.
Okay. Can we go back to the slide before the first session?
This slide?
Yes, yes. First of all, the January thing, first, only been provided by managed long-term care program, and when you look at about, April, 2012. What I'm understanding is differentiation between MLT and one corn age model. The MLT
hold on 1 second. I'm just trying to figure out why we have music.
We have the
Somebody has muted their line.
Somebody has it on hold.
Oh, someone of the 300 people has it on hold.
Exactly.
Okay. Marilyn, sorry, back to you.
So what is the difference then if MLTC is already doing that?
Well, this slide specifically is dealing with the mainstream program because currently personal care is not in the Medicaid managed care mainstream benefit, and that's what the phase-in, as I indicated, personal care is coming in August, and for PERS it comes in January. The difference between the MLTC and the care coordination model, I think, is something that the committee is charged to try to define.
And my one other comment is there's great concern about personal care programs.
You mean the mainstream program?
Right, who have absolutely no experience of enjoying themselves of payment for care documents.
Valencia, can you just elaborate a little bit on this issue of personal care and nursing home services within the mainstream programs and those that will be part of the managed long-term care model?
Sure. As you indicated, personal care and PERS is currently in the managed long-term care program. Relating to your comment about personal care going into mainstream plans, we're aware that there is heightened concern with that, and we've done a lot of work with the local districts and also in trying to have discussions with the vendors and plans to try to promote a smooth transition. Plans have been required to develop internal systems and policies and procedures and to develop contracts with vendors who are currently providing the service to try to minimize the amount of disruption that would occur to consumers. So we're hoping that if people do hear of some major issues as this rolls out, that you'll bring it to our attention and we'll try to address it at that time. But there are a lot of issues that we have been trying to address.
So why would someone opt for one and not the other? So if I'm a consumer and I'm right now, I have to make a choice of going into managed long-term care or staying in an MMC. What would the advantages of being in an MMC if I'm a person with a disability and the plan has no expertise in that?
I think that, as I indicated before, for the non-dual population, the waiver that we apply, the amendments to the waiver that is before CMS would allow us to expand the populations that are going to enroll. And therefore, for non-duals, the benefit package for the mainstream program will now include the long-term care services or some of them, and as we go out, the nursing home. That's why nursing home will be provided into plans. And what we're trying to create is for the mainstream program to have the full continuum from the beginning to the end of life in plans, so that the non-dual population will minimize the exposure to the state by having them enroll in an integrated comprehensive model. And so there is a choice for the adult disabled, but I think what we're looking at is at some point in the end that we want everyone in a fully integrated model, and our concerns are that the non-dual population will be required to enroll into an integrated model in the end.
Okay, Joanne.
You spoke a little bit about the total number that are currently enrolled. Will there be a presentation or discussion by region? Because I think there are obviously, for many people's minds, significant differences between a heavily populated area like New York City in terms of capacity, availability, and maybe upstate New York, particularly as you move into the rural areas. So will that kind of information be provided along the way?
Yes, Pat has some information. I don't know if his numbers are broken out upstate, downstate, but when we speak about mandatory enrollment, I should have indicated that, and I apologize. Mandatory enrollment will begin in New York City where capacity currently exists. Capacity is being defined currently with two managed long-term care programs. And so we were starting in New York City. For the upstate, there are many areas upstate where there is no plan, and that will be reflected on the slide that is coming up shortly.
Yes, Betty.
Betty Mullen, Deposer. Just a clarification on the slide where you referred to the therapy limits. Now, is this limit that apply to the Medicaid side, or is this folding in Medicare eligibility as well?
because under Medicare, there's a certain set of rules about therapy eligibility, and then once that expires, then you move into Medicaid reimbursement. So is it strictly what's eligible under Medicaid, and is it 20 for all three therapies or 20 each?
It applies to Medicaid. It's a Medicaid benefit change for all Medicaid members, and I believe it's 20 each, but I'll have to clarify that. I'll need to clarify that. I believe it's 20 each, but I'll try to clarify that before the meeting is over for you.
Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other questions just on the benefits and the changes afoot before Valencia continues? Okay, Valencia. Great.
Okay. So the first change, I think, substantive change that we're seeing with the Managed Long-Term Care Program will occur in September 2011. Currently, the local districts are responsible for the enrollment of individuals into managed long-term care plans and ensuring that people who enroll are nursing home certifiable and can stay in the community. As of September 2011, we're modifying that process. The local districts will no longer be required to ensure that a person is nursing home certifiable. Plans will be able to outreach and enroll individuals. However, there still will be a relationship with the local districts in dealing with eligibility relating to the new process, but it won't be eligibility to enroll in an MLTC. It looks at the eligibility of the member as a Medicaid consumer. The state will have a retrospective audit function for all of the managed long-term care programs for the period of September through moving into a mandatory program. And the purpose of that audit really is to ensure that plans are enrolling only those persons who are nursing home certifiable, because that is the requirement in order to enroll in a managed long-term care program currently. And as we move into mandatory, those eligibility requirements will change. So in April 2012, providing that we get approval from CMS, the state has submitted an amendment to the 1115 waiver, which would allow us to begin mandatory enrollment in New York City for individuals, dual eligibles over 21, who need community-based long-term care services for more than 120 days. We would require them to enroll in a managed long-term care program or an alternate care coordination model, which will be defined, hopefully, by this work group. It eliminates the need to be nursing home certifiable. Basically, the requirement is that if you need long-term care services over 120 days, and if you're over 21, you would be required to enroll in one of those models. The definition of community-based long-term care services is still under discussion. However, we are looking at using personal care, home care, and those receiving adult day health care would be required to enroll. As many of you know, there is a uniform assessment tool being developed, and right now plans are required to use the semiannual assessment tool for members on every 6 months. However, when their uniform assessment tool is developed by the state, plans will be required to use that tool in the place of SAM.
Another question, sorry, going back to your slide about mandatory initiatives. What's the rationale for eliminating nursing home eligibility for enrollment?
Okay, Mark, do you want to take that?
Sure. I mean, the governor proposed, the legislature adopted the standard of 120 days in need of community-based long-term care services as the standard for enrollment. So moving away from the nursing home eligibility criteria. And the new criteria will be that people are in need of those types of community-based services for more than 120 days.
And the rationale is?
It was basically to move as many people as we could into the managed care setting.
Dave.
David McNally, ARP. If the local social service district is no longer involved, who is handling the enrollment? I'm not quite sure I understand that.
The plans are completing, working with the consumer to complete the enrollment application, and it's submitted to the local district, and they will put it in the system. But their role of validating the enrollment application and the level of care is eliminated.
But, I mean, like, who's offering the consumer what the choices are in the first place? I mean,
we will use the enrollment broker, the state's enrollment broker, to assist in educating the population. The local district will still provide information to consumers on choices that are available, and plans will also be required to educate consumers and inform them of choices that are available to them.
The plans are informing the consumers of what the choices are?
In addition to those other options, they're required to.
There's a number of other activities underway, not the least of which is a work group on state and local responsibilities. And I think one of the issues that comes up with the move to managed care and the discussion about state assumption of eligibility, which is, as you know, in discussion at this point, is the role of the local government in terms of assuring that the populations in need in their communities receive the information necessary to make informed choices. That's not necessarily within the scope of this work group. Could be discussed within this work group, but it may fall into the scope of others as well.
And if somebody does not make a choice, who's assigning the choice or the plan or the...
If individuals do not select plans that have received an enrollment packet, the way it would roll out, and that's part of what we are still working on, is how to roll it out in the most effective and efficient way. If individuals that receive the enrollment packet does not make a choice, which is proposed within 30 days, that is before CMS also to approve. Currently, we have a 60-day and a 90-day choice period. But if that individual does not choose, the state will assign them to a plan.
The state being who exactly? I mean,
the Department of Health.
Someone in the Department of Health.
The Department of Health will make the assignment.
And similarly, questions if I wanted to disenroll or I wanted to try to get an exemption, who as the customer or the consumer would I deal with?
Well, currently in our mainstream program, for disenrollments and enrollments, we use our enrollment broker and the local district to assist clients
right.
in doing that.
Currently.
And we will, the role of the enrollment broker will be expanded to also respond to managed long-term care enrollment, disenrollment issues. Also, we have complaint lines for people to make calls and request actions. And so there are multiple venues for individuals to reach out to make a change their status or to request an exemption.
Yes,
I'm sorry.
Melanie.
Oh, sorry, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is obviously this is an issue which we'll be talking about in the work group, and we can present, you know, at a subsequent meeting all the, you know, consumer protections and rights and such. It's probably a good idea to walk through people's actual process currently in place and then our thinking on the process in April.
Okay, Melanie.
We're interested in what kind of information people will actually get about what the plan is doing, how many people end up in their facilities through that plan, how many people have to, how many hours of personal care and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So very specific so that the choice is a real one between, you know, different types of plans and not just, you know, whatever floppy looks like plans that have. And we're also obviously very interested in the protection of the legal rights of folks in the enrollment process.
Sure. Okay. All right. Yes. Marilyn.
Marilyn Saviola. I just wanted a clarification. You said as of September, there will be mandatory enrollments for duals.
No, that was April.
September, the role of the local district.
Okay. So what happens to the non-duals? The Medicaid only.
Non-duals, currently there are a large number of non-duals that are already required to enroll in mainstream managed care. And we have, there are some exemptions and exclusions that the state has that exempt certain populations from being required to enroll.
we have submitted an amendment to our 1115 waiver, which would allow the state to mandatorily enroll non-duals into the mainstream program.
Okay.
You
would be able to share that with us?
What would you like? The amendment is actually on the web.
No, but I mean, what are the exemptions
that are being eliminated?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay, so let me just try and capture, because I've heard two issues, and I want to be sure that you get all the issues here. So if I haven't captured at least what I hear as the main issues, let me know. But one issue that I think we need to come back to is the dual versus the non-dual, and really understanding the road that those will travel. And then the second issue that I heard was really reviewing the whole process of choice, the education, the how do you make a choice that reflects a real knowledge base and an ability to compare plans, and what's the protections if you want to disenroll from the plan. So that's what the second big issue that I have heard that we want to capture and come back to.
Could I also ask about enrollment brokers? Who are they? Are they equipped on long-term care issues like this for the duals in particular, but in general about assignment? Is there some conflict of interest issues here with those who are the brokers? It's all kind of a mystery to me, to be completely honest with you.
Okay, well, I'm going to subsume that under this whole selection process.
Okay, but in the interim, could somebody just tell me who they are?
Currently, the state has one enrollment broker, and that's Maximus, and they function statewide.
And so would there be more than one enrollment broker?
We don't think that there will be, but there could possibly be in the future. Right now, we are working with only one enrollment broker.
Okay, so we're going to come back to this whole issue. Kevin.
Yeah, Carol, I just wanted to add one thing, and that's for the continuity of care in this transition. I think Valencia alluded to it earlier that there's some problems, and there's a lot of problems out there, and we've got only a couple weeks until this first phase goes in. So I think we need to address that. In fact, I'd like to talk about it a bit today if we could.
Okay, so we will try to come back to that one and at least explain what are the key issues there. Joanne, I didn't forget you. You had a point you wanted to make. Go ahead.
Well, I also just want to follow up on this. I still think the geographic issue is going to be really an important issue because capacity can be defined many different ways. The numbers of plans today don't necessarily equate to capacity either clinically or substantively. The specific question I guess I had maybe goes back to Mark a little bit. On those people over 120 days and maybe it's a capacity question, is it anticipated care for over 120 days, actual having received care for over 120 days, what happens to care for 90 days, stabilize, whatever, may not need care, and then another event occurs, and they may start the clock ticking.
That's a great question that we are wrestling with, and, you know, the statute just says in need of care over 120 days, so our presumption going into the process would be that upon discharge from hospital or upon episode, it would be the expectation of 120 days. Obviously, that is going to take care of a wide swath of people, but there are a lot of people that, as you mentioned, that are going to be kind of in the middle, like 90-day people, or people that, you know, have a 6-day episode and then may have another episode. So we're kind of philosophically trying to frame it as upon episode, the expectation would be that they would need community-based long-term care services for more than 120 days. You know, an event or something, an episode, realizing that's not going to take care of everyone. And then, you know, we more than want to bounce around kind of the other populations and try to get to a piece, an agreement on that. The statute, this is, you know, broad. So we have, you know, a lot of flexibility, and we have, you know, some time, not a lot of time, but some time to kind of figure that out. But those are all good questions that we are wrestling with internally.
Okay. Well, before Valencia goes on, is there anyone else who hasn't asked a question that has any point to make? Okay, Mary.
Mary Harper, your city HRA.
As the non
as the non-duals go into mainstream managed care and managed care benefit package increases to include long-term care services. Did I understand correctly that there will be no application of the uniform assessment tool on those clients so that as they require long-term care services, they're getting the same kind of judgment that a person in long-term care would get? Is that correct?
Yeah, at this point, that is correct. The uniform assessment tool process is and we can obviously provide a lot more information on this, is it's still working through the beta and the pilot process, so we want to make sure we get it right and do it carefully and thoughtfully. So at this point, that would not be that would not be part of the uniform assessment system. Ultimately, as this gets rolled out in a comprehensive way, I could see that being a good marriage there, but we're not close to that marriage yet. So at this point, no, they will not be part of the UAS system.
Okay. Joe, did you have a question?
Yes, Joe Healy, CTM. Not so much a question, but an issue. I was going to wait till later because it's a sort of detail, but I think it's a fundamental issue when we get to April 2012. It's logistics. It's about operations, and it has to do with time. If we say that the clock starts on April 1, 2012, then what is the time frame over which people who qualify, who need to be educated, who need to make choices and plans, even in New York City where there's a lot of capacity, what is the time frame over which the mandatory enrollment actually gets implemented? And because I assume we'd all like to maximize choice, consumer education, and minimize the amount of auto assignment that we're doing.
Okay, so I think that crosses over the issue that Dave raised, and it also crosses the issue that Kevin raised, which is what's the transition here. I think there was one other person. Okay, Kathy.
Kathy, sure. I'm wondering, and this may be something that you're still working on, but you have an existing population of people that are using long-term care services in the community, and so those are already identified to you. You know who they are. But I'm wondering how people that newly enter the system, say upon discharge from a hospital, how are you going to identify them and their needs for, and whether they should be enrolled, and what would be the timing of that? Is that going to be part of discharge planning, or is it going to be something you identify once they're already out in the community and receiving services?
Yeah, that is clearly a work in progress. That is one of the fundamental questions that we have to grapple with, because we do not want to have a system which either backs people up in the hospital or doesn't give people the appropriate choice and independence in the community. So how exactly that's going to work is definitely a work in progress, and we have some thoughts about it, but we have not reached the conclusion about that.
I think you also don't want 6 months to go by where their care isn't being coordinated at a point when they're vulnerable.
Right, so absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different factors involved with that decision, and I think, we need more discussion on that, both internally and externally, and I think, hopefully collectively we can reach a consensus on that.
Okay. All right, Valencia, back to you. Okay.
The next area we were looking at is care coordination models, which has come up several times. And again, there are models that meet guidelines that are specified by the commissioner. Those guidelines have not been developed, and we're hoping that, the work group will take time to give us input on what those guidelines should be. We did include in your packet the statutes that allow the development of care coordination models did have a minimum requirement that they reference in statute, and that is included in the work group members' package for your own benefit. And we are working to ensure that there are payment methods for the care coordination models that ensure provider accountability and cost-effective quality outcomes. The care coordination models could include long-term home health care programs, providing that they meet the guidelines, and also other entities that may also meet the guidelines which qualify for care coordination models. This team, again, as I indicated, was appointed to provide the commissioner with input on what those guidelines should be, and the statute requires us to post the guidelines by November 15, 2011.
I think I've covered this already, but it basically it talks about the mandatory enrollment in 2012, the fact that we're working with HRAs since we're going to begin in New York City to come up with the best way to transition the population. We realize that it can't happen all at once, and we're trying to determine what would be the trigger to require a person to enroll. Would it be on reassessment of services by borough? There are other ways in which you could target individuals for them to be required to enroll. However, we will see a gradual rollout, and the anticipation is that there would be approximately 2,000 members a month, but that, again, is not a definitive.
Yes,
Dave.
David McNally, ARP. Can we go back to the guidelines for the care coordination model? It says Medicaid redesign team work group. Yeah, I know that. Thank you, Carol. To assist in the development. So does that mean to assist in the development of the guidelines? And if so, are there other opportunities for consumers to be involved in developing the guidelines? Or is it just this work group, or will there be other opportunities for consumer groups to be involved in developing the guidelines?
So that is a great question. Obviously, the work group, you know, you guys are were appointed and are going to be key to that process. We have a lot of different other avenues for input. Please announce we literally just established an email system where people can literally came across the BlackBerry about 5 minutes ago. It's up on the website for people to make comments on this question, you know, public member consumers, others, everyone. We are trying to be as transparent as possible. One thing about the Medicaid redesign team I think people like is that there's a lot of information on the website. There's a lot of things that are happening, and a lot of, it's very transparent. Of course, we will meet with people. We will talk to people. People should send emails into us. You know, as public servants, we are responsible to the citizenry. So, you know, anyone that's got an idea or a constructive comment, you know, we're more than willing to take. So, you know, this is very much we're at the beginning of the process on the guidelines. We're not at the end, and so we need as much input as possible.
So if the guidelines are to be posted on the DOH website by November 15th,
right,
and today is July 8th,
right,
and we have two meetings, and just Carol, you mentioned there may be other phone calls and so forth. Mark, other than email, are there other structures or systems? I mean, how will we know when the guidelines are done?
Well, you'll be.
I mean, will they be put out for comment?
We haven't worked on that out yet. I mean, let's be honest. We're just trying to run as fast as we can on the committee. So we haven't figured that out yet. Obviously, the governor's office would need to clear the guidelines, so we need to back it up somewhat. Jim and his team need time to look at that and those guidelines. We're going to have an active summer and early fall on this issue. So I don't think it's going to be, years. I think we're going to be working and as hard as we can and getting drafts going as best as we can. I don't think we've worked out an exact timeline yet.
Thank you.
All right, Marilyn.
A concern is most people with disabilities that we serve don't have access to the computer. No, nor do seniors. So having a website with information doesn't help them.
Yes.
But I'd like to
good, very, let me just, that's a very good concern, and, we expect the advocacy community that represents those people to will do their magic and make sure that's available. We'll make it available in other ways
so
as well.
So what I would like you to ask, and it's so proposed, is that we could be a series of one or two open meetings where the advocates could come present to us what the concerns and issues of the people they represent.
Well, we are going to spend some time thinking through what's the best process, but thank you for that proposal for right now. We will consider that along with some others. Anyone else who wants to make a point? All right, if not, Valencia.
For the initial mandatory enrollment that will begin, that is proposed to begin, providing we get CMS approval in April 2012, there are groups that are not eligible that will not be required to enroll in managed long-term care or the care coordination models. And those are the waiver programs that you see, traumatic brain injury, nursing home transition and diversion, assisted living program, and the Office of People with Developmental Disabilities waivers. We are working on the best way to ensure that once this population is targeted for enrollment, that there are appropriate models in place that can respond to their needs. So they will not be required to enroll in April 2012.
Go ahead.
With respect to OPWDD waiver, what is the connection between the waiver development process, the new 1115 waiver there, and this process?
Commissioner Burke has, as you may know, has undertaken a process of stakeholder engagement for the purposes of developing the 1115 waiver proposal. There's a degree of urgency about that proposal in light of existing CMS concerns, funding arrangements, and so on. So we're determined to move that along on as fast a track as we could. There'll clearly be opportunities to inform this work group and other parts of the MRT as that effort begins to reach milestone decision making, but largely it's intended to proceed as a separate independent effort.
Okay, Valencia.
This is just a slide that reflects how we are looking at capacity currently, meaning with the number of plans that are operational. As you can see, there's a lot of blue that just shows that there are no managed care plans, partially capitated managed long-term care plans in those counties. There are some of those counties in blue that have PACE models and possibly MAP models, but we were looking at the managed long-term care plans to be existing in those areas before we would propose to expand the mandatory. And again, as we are indicated previously, the target will be downstate in New York City where capacity currently exists, as defined by at least two MLTCs. As I indicated, because we are promoting growth and we are trying to expand the program upstate, we are encouraging the development of managed long-term care programs. There is an application that's currently on the web. And there are applications for expansions and also new lines of business that are available. All of the applicants would have to comply with the appropriate legal structure, contracted network, care models, grievance systems, and other programmatic requirements that are currently in statute for the development of managed long-term care plans. And I think the application would be reflective of that. Just as background, the statute allows up to 75 managed long-term care plans to be created throughout the state. Currently, we have 23 operational long-term care, managed long-term care plans, two in application status, 50 are available for establishment, and of that 50, we have to reserve 8 slots for the Senate and the Assembly to recommend applicants. And there is a website available if there are questions relating to the application process or the application that is currently online. Recently, the department received the dual plan grant from CMS, and the planning grant was to try to come up with models to integrate care for the duals, which would allow the state to benefit from some type of cost share or savings that occurs on the Medicare side. And so we included these as possible areas for the state to continue to review assumption of Medicare risk in New York State. We do have access to Medicare data now that Pat may speak to a little bit more, but that data will allow us to see if that is a very appropriate model for the state to pursue. We included the development of enhanced care coordination for nursing home residents, promotion of the existing managed long-term care initiatives as we define with mandatory enrollment, and any type of gain sharing that we do that would be probably a step below assuming full Medicare risk. So those are some of the initiatives that we did include. However, I think by having the planning grant, we are open for discussion. These may not be the right models, and they may be the right areas to focus on, but wanted to give you background on what those were.
Kathy Short.
I just wanted to ask a question in terms of timing. That planning grant is for a year, I think, correct? So when exactly are you supposed to have a waiver developed or a proposal developed for that?
I believe we have to have a proposal to CMS, and don't quote me on it. I think it's February or April, one of them.
Of 2012.
April. Yeah.
April 2012.
Yes.
Okay. Was there another question?
Can I?
Sure. Kathy.
So this could, in some ways, this expansion of mandatory managed care could somewhat be a bridge to something more comprehensive, correct?
I think that's a very important point, which I want to capture, because I think one of the challenges we're going to have as a work group is how to think about managed long-term care as a bridge to the integration, and just to make sure that what we do here facilitates integration down the road rather than
Again, we spoke about some of the planning activities, looking at the Medicare, Medicaid expenditures. We do in plan as part of that planning grant to have stakeholder meetings and interviews. We are currently soliciting a vendor that will assist us in doing that in order to get feedback from consumers, and the application is due to CMS in April 2012. And hopefully we will begin implementation in the fall of 2012. And hopefully we'll be able to obtain additional funding from CMS for the implementation of the planning initiative. Cal, I think there's a question.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Doug.
Hi, Doug Guggen-Callahan from Medicare Rights. Although I think it's important to use this work group and the managed long-term care model as a bridge to potential broader initiatives for the cares for dual eligibles in New York in respect to this planning grant. I just wanted to know, I mean, is the state looking to other types of demonstrations and other types of models to consider other than managed care? I know that particularly for the non-duals, the managed care model in Medicare has sometimes not been the most advantageous method of care for folks.
It depends a little bit what you mean by managed care model, I think. Part of the charge of this work group is to look at what would be defined as appropriate care management model. That would be an expectation that the recommendations would be for this group and others, but the intent is to resolve this policy issue over the course of the next several months.
Just as an observation, when the discussion started, there isn't necessarily one model to fit all. So I think other models can be introduced, and certainly to the extent that it can be shared, we can consider it.
Okay. Valencia, you want to wrap?
So this is just a summary, basically, of what the next steps would be. We do have several long-term care models to expand those to include the care coordination models. There is a major redesign of the current managed care infrastructure, mainstream and managed long-term care. There are transitions to care management and capitated models that hold accountability. It's the direction that the state is moving in, and I think it creates a great opportunity for this group to be part of that development. And we have the opportunity to develop some integrated programs for the state to improve the outcomes of the dual eligible population, but also to benefit from any savings on the Medicare side that we believe should come to New York State. there is a lot of work that's needed in a short time frame, and our mission and our goal is to make sure that all of these transitions occur as smoothly as possible and that we maintain consumer protection while trying to improve the quality of their care. And with that, thank goodness.
So, Valencia, thank you very much. I think there's just one issue I want to add from Valencia's presentation, and that's sort of the issue around the Care for One Nation model that we have to really come back to. And I think the question will also be, how does that intersect with the application process to manage long-term care that's ongoing today, and how does that intersect with the planning grant for integrating the care for the dual? So we just have to think about that as we think about the Care for One Nation model. So let me just recap before we turn to Patrick and make sure that from the working perspective we haven't missed any key issues. We have the dual versus non-dual, the whole selection process, and I think, Kathy, I'm going to subsume your issue about what if you're poised to discharge from a hospital, how do you really get into the system? And then the continuity of care transition issue, the issue price, which is on capacity, how you make one capacity, and I think the last one is on the whole issue of care coordination model. We tackle that and how exactly we connect with other activities that are already on. Hey, Mark.
On the care coordination model, I think it's important for us to ultimately come up with models, plural, as opposed to a model, because the person should not fit the model, but the model should fit the person. And I think that's a very critical element in caring for the variations, the themes relative to care coordination and delivery of care.
And we're
going to
call that the
lay
principle.
Or the patient.
Okay. All right, Melanie.
We talked about the consumer's rights and protections as kind of an issue within all these issues, and Mark talked a little bit about maybe doing an overview of that, but I would just want to emphasize that that's a major concern within each almost all of those different areas as well.
Are there any other comments from anyone who hasn't spoken? Michael, Alan.
This is Michael Burma. I think an observation that I'd make as we go forward is we have an incredibly broad and important set of challenges, and we have scarce capacity and limited time. And I just want to be, I think the group should be aware of the tension between two important threads of the conversation. One is a Medicaid managed care enrollment and administration conversation, which is extremely important. We have a lot of experience with that over the last 15 years in New York State. The other one is a long-term care service delivery reform and care management conversation. And both of those conversations can occupy all of the capacity, time, oxygen at our disposal and more. And we've got to make sure that we nail both. So I just think we should sort of keep that in mind.
Well, you know, I made this point at the larger Medicaid redesign team, and it's something that I feel, which is all of the people we enroll and manage long-term care need services. So we have to just be aware of that. That is unusual in most managed care plans where every single enrollee needs services. So that's kind of just embellishing what you said, Michael, which we have to somehow look at both ends of this. Okay, Alan?
Alan Morris. I think one of the things, Carol, that we need to also focus on is some of the operational characteristics which maybe get lumped under capacity.
But in order to enroll the kinds of numbers that we're starting to see, there have to be systemic changes in the system. Already it's starting to back up as CHAS, for example, are discharging large numbers of patients. HRA has capacity issues in terms of how many cases they can currently process. And I think that there's a significant possibility for enrollees to get lost in the process, and it's becoming very cumbersome for them. I had a meeting yesterday, and I was made aware that the system that HRA has, which determines the, I'm going to use the wrong term here, the exemptions or the exclusions, the exclusion categories, is not accessible by the plans. So we go through an enormous process of review, evaluation, assessment. Case gets sent down to HRA, and then we find out that for one reason or another they're not eligible, which we couldn't have known before because we don't have access to that data. So ways of simplifying data access, of submitting data, for example, HRA still doesn't accept applications electronically.
Mm-hmm.
Via, right?
Okay.
Would be a great asset for all of us because we just the logistics of dealing with the numbers of applications, the paperwork, and from the member's point of view, or the applicant's point of view, process. I think
okay.
We have a lot of work.
All right, Kate, do you want to offer any observations before we move on?
I just talked a little bit about Mark's observation about the many models and coming from upstate and knowing that there are not very many models and those that are limited out there, it's been very difficult to grow the capacity because of limited service availability and a lot of different geographic factors out there. So really it is important as we look at what it looks like downstate, this whole program may be a completely different model or model upstate just to meet those needs.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Joe.
Joe Healy, if I could make one other comment, building on what Alan said, he went to the sort of streamlining issue. There's another issue I thought he was going to raise that I'd like to flag for the group. There are other work teams moving forward as part of Medicaid reform, and one of the things that we ought to look for are interdependencies across the teams. One of the things that's accelerating enrollment right now is the capping of reimbursement for the CHAS. That's sort of in a different space, but it clearly is impacting managed long-term care right now. So as the work groups move forward doing their work to figure out how to implement various aspects of reform, we ought to be watching for other interdependencies. And I would assume folks at DOH are the right folks to do that.
Okay, Carol.
Carol Rodette, I assume under consumer protections we're going to tackle the issue of fair hearing?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Kevin, Mark, Kathy, George, anyone else before we move on this side?
I just wanted to raise one thing. I'm not sure if it goes where it goes here, but once we have people in programs, what's the model for regulating that in the sense of guaranteeing the right type of care? And when I see that we're going to add 50 companies through an application process into managed long-term care business, you know, who are they going to contract with? What are those relationships going to be, and how much can DOH guarantee that consumers are protected through some sort of process? I don't know where that's going to fit in, but we seem to be focused on the front end here as opposed to the continuity of care and guarantees that consumers are getting what they need.
Kevin, if you look on the sheet for the agenda,
we have
it's included in terms of the care and outcomes of the target population and the way you measure performance.
Right.
So it's at the top of our list as one of the items to be discussed, and ultimately we have to come up with recommendations.
Okay, anyone else on this side before we go back to Marilyn? You're going to have the concluding comment.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
In terms of staff hearing rights, I often wear the hat of being the plan rep at a fair hearing, and it's an extremely difficult situation for a plan and for the consumers, but the standard is that managed long-term care plans have to provide the minimum standard of Medicaid. Each plan, and it's not, so that's the bottom line. So in Plan A, you would buy XYZ types of wheelchairs. And plan B, no, we don't provide XY, we provide ABC. And in talking about fair hearing rights, it's extremely hard for consumers of the plan and for the ALJ to think, well, it depends which plan is paying it. What is your, you know, if your only standard of giving a service is that you have to provide the minimum of what Medicaid service does, how does, if the issue becomes that each plan interprets this difference, and if each plan interprets it different, it's a real problem for fair hearing. For every, for the consumer, the plan, and the state, as far as adjudicating that.
All right, thank you. Now, Mark, are you next or is Patrick?
I'm going to go next.
Okay, go ahead.
Patrick. So, thanks, Carol. The next section here is kind of really a level set on what the current waivers are in the major state plan services. It should be not new information for a lot of people, but I wanted to make sure that we put it in context. You know, the state has a long history with 1915C home community-based waiver programs. They're listed here. A lot of them are operated by the Department of Health, and some are operated by the mental hygiene agencies. And we have the Bridges to Health out of the Office of Home and Family Services. So we have a long tradition of 1915C waivers. And these are, what are 1915C waivers? They're really within the federal guidelines, the flexibility to meet specific needs of targeted populations. So I'm not going to read the actual requirements, or you can read it yourself. But basically, it's the way the federal government looks at the Medicaid program says you're able to state, as our partner, able to waive certain things or develop specific programs and have flexibility to meet populations. So all our I'm just going to talk about the DOH waivers in a sense, leaving the mental hygiene waivers to another conversation of the time. But all our DOH waivers, participants must be Medicaid eligible, obviously. The care home waiver allows non-Medicaid to participate. They must live in the community or transition from nursing home or hospital to the community. The cost neutrality requirements are cost neutral versus a comparable institution, either a nursing home or hospital. And approximately 30,000 people are served annually under the DOH waiver. Big waiver is a long historical big waiver that we've had is the long-term home health care program, also known as the Lombardi program after Senator Lombardi, or the Nursing Home Without Walls program. It's operated by the department, administered by the local districts. We also obviously monitor the agency operations and the local district program administration. You have to have a nursing home level of care to be in the Lombardi or the long-term health care program. You have to be Medicaid eligible, and that the cost of care in the community must be less than 75% of the average nursing facility cost for the county residents, with allowance to go to 100% in certain circumstances. There's no age limitation on this waiver. We have some pediatric long-term health care programs. The vast majority of the applicants are old or elderly. This is approved. The first waiver was approved back in 1983. That was my first year in college, just for people to know. So it was a great year, too. But exactly right. When I see that thing, I figure that it's been a long time since 1983. And it's been a great program. It's an ongoing, it's a valuable resource to the community and to many people that it serves. We just got authorization to do another 5 years until August 31st of 2015 after a long struggle with CMS about spousal empowerment rules and other things. We have more than 26,000 people receiving long-term home care services with a 16-9 New York City rest of the state. Average length of stay of the program is 234 days, and there's 107 long-term home health care providers statewide. This is I'm not going to read this slide. It's about the extent of the waiver services available under the long-term home health care program. And there's extensive care management in this waiver provided by our installed participants. And this is what they do. It's not discreetly billed a service, but it's incorporated into the rates for all the other services. The other big waiver that we have, one of the other big waivers is the TBI or traumatic brain injury waiver, which is established in the state law of 1994. There's a state law that was enacted with this waiver and a couple other things to really deal with this TBI population. It's had aggregate cost neutrality as opposed to individual cost neutrality. So in aggregate, the population must be comparable to a comparable population in the nursing facility. This is operated differently than the long-term health care program and the regular Medicaid program in that it's kind of outsourced to these regional resource development center contractors who are our agent, our contractor, and the federal state government's contractor for initial point of contact, day-to-day activities, and review and approval of all service plans. So instead of the local districts, we do use the nine regional resource development center contractor route. You have to be diagnosed with a TBI between the ages of 18 and 64 and have to have a nursing home level of care. Approximately 2,600 people or prisoners are in this waiver. Current authorization is until August 31 of 2013. The average length of stay in this waiver is more than a year. It's 404 days. Again, the list of services, which looks very similar to other waivers, but it's there for your reference. And on this waiver, in the HGD waiver, there was enacted a housing subsidy, a state general fund housing subsidy that came with this waiver. Approximately 1,500 waiver participants received subsidies paid for by state government, and there's a contract arrangement with a payment agent. So this waiver and the HGD waiver also have a housing piece to it. The next waiver is the Nursing Home Transition Diversion Waiver, NHTD, as we call it. Is enacted in 04, 05, it's basically, again, an aggregate cost neutrality comparable nursing facility. It follows the TBI, Regional Resource Development Center model, not the local district model. And you have to be between the ages of 18 and 64 with a physical disability or age 65 or older, Medicaid eligible, obviously, and nursing home facility level of care. The first waiver, it took a while to get this waiver up and running. First waiver participant was enrolled in 08. We have authorization to 2015. Approximately 1,000 people are in the waiver. 145 receive a state-funded housing subsidy, and the average length of stay is 128 days. Now, that average length of stay number, I say, is really, it reflects a phase-in of participants over years. That's not necessarily a comparable number. 55% are between are under 64, 45% are over 65. It's different than the other waivers. Again, a very comprehensive list of waiver services, and this has a housing subsidy as well. This subsidy, we actually work with our colleagues at the New York State Homes and Community Renewal, the DHCR, have a memorandum of understanding with them so they can operate the housing subsidy to link their housing programs together. That's a somewhat recent development. Then we have the Care at Home waivers for the often referred to as the Katie Beckett program. Care at Home 1, 2, we have to come up with better names than 1 and 2, but 1 requires a skilled facility nursing level of care. 2 requires technology dependence upon a ventilator. This is operated by DOH and administered to the local districts. Kids under 18, physically disabled according to standards of the Social Security Act, and financially eligibility. Child is Medicaid eligible or family has been determined ineligible for Medicaid based on income resources. But child is Medicaid eligible when parents' income resources are not counted. So this allows a different eligibility criteria for kids. First established in 85, current waiver through 2015, approximately 700 program participants, 194 are Medicaid eligible children, and average length of stay of the waiver is 418 days. This has a lot of services, respite, case management, home adaptation, vehicle modifications, palliative care services. We added recently in the waiver a bunch of services on the palliative care side. So that's a very important waiver, small but important waiver, and if you ever have experience with that waiver and talk to the families, it's a very important part of the long-term care system in the state. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the state plan, very extensive state plan services we have under Medicaid. Community-based long-term care. Personal care is the biggie. It was an optional Medicaid benefit added to the state plan in 73, expanded 73, which is a long time ago, and expanded in the late 80s and early 90s to include a number of different things. So these different programs are operated PERS, ALP, Limited License Home Care Service Agency, consumer-directed, under the personal care rubric as far as the federal government goes. These are all funded under the personal care state plan option. Personal care eligibility must require some or total assistance with personal hygiene, dressing, feeding, nutritional, and environmental support ordered by a physician and based on an assessment of the patient's medical needs. There's a medical assessment and a social assessment done. Individual must be medically stable. do not need to be nursing home eligible to participate in the program. A lot of people are nursing home eligible that are in the program, but do not need to be. Of course, must be Medicaid eligible. The personal care statistics, we've done many slides on this in the past. I just had staff do a quick update on the 2010 numbers, which is really 62,000 people receiving personal care services in 2010, 4516 as far as New York City and the rest of the state split. This is kind of just a slide that goes through the age ranges, rest of state, New York City, and tells you where the age ranges are. I tried to find a story in this slide. The only real story I could find was the, if you look at the 21 to 64 is rest of state, are more percentage than they are in New York City. And we see that talking to the districts upstate that the 21 to 64s are a growing population in the rest of the state. This is an interesting stat on statewide hours authorized. The average hours per recipient statewide is 1665, with New York City obviously having a lot higher average hours at 2026, and upstate, rest of state, at 630. So this is an example of the wide variation in the Medicaid program in the state. Same benefit, but the way it's organized and delivered is different depending where you live. Can I? Sure.
Betty Mullen,
sure.
Is
your
mic
on?
It's on, yeah.
Okay.
So what do you attribute this stark difference?
There's not one thing you can say there. There's many different factors. One is workforce availability. One is the way the system evolved over time. You know, the nursing home system in the city, the number of beds in the city is somewhat less on a per capita basis than upstate. And just, you know, the way the system was organized and grown through the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s, that's kind of the historical, the way the program has grown. The other thing is, frankly, in upstate, the districts have controlled utilization because the district authorized at the district level. So there's been a control in the upstate local district level that has been different than the control of New York City. While they have controls in New York City, the approach has been different in New York City, upstate. I don't know, Michael, you've done some work on this. I don't know if you want to.
What is your proposed model?
Wait. Hold on. Why don't we just turn to Michael, and then we'll go back to Betty. Go ahead.
Sure. I mean, I thought it was a really good question, and I liked the different components of the answer, but I think I'd characterize it a little bit differently, and I'd say, you know, as a sort of threshold observation, it's not an apples-to-apples comparison.
That's correct.
Because the people that you're looking at who are receiving personal care services in New York City and who are not resident in nursing homes in New York City because of New York City's personal care program are not in the comparison group upstate because there isn't enough personal care capacity to keep them out of nursing homes. So you're not comparing similar cohorts.
So is there a tool that measures the various acuity or experiences and disability that says you have apples here and oranges here?
Well, there's not one tool, and that's frankly, we've done a lot of work with the City of New York and thanks to Mary Harper and her staff and on the data available. That's a question that's been asked for, I'd say, 10 years since I've been working on this or more. As how do you really compare the personal care program upstate and downstate, and what really is the driving factors, and is the disability level different than others? And we don't really have that answer. Another one of the driving factors of the uniform assessment tool was to try to get, you know, some of this data availability and answers. And Pat Ruin's going to talk later in his slides about the data that is available, but there's a lot of data that's just not available. The way the system has evolved, it's a paper system. The assessment systems are all paper upstate as well as downstate and in the city, and it doesn't lend itself to a real closely data analysis. So there's been some sampling done, we've done some other things, but there's not the rich data set that we have on this program that we as policymakers really should have to
Mark, one other thing as we go forward, for the other waiver programs, you had duration, length of service,
right,
and also the components of their services.
Right.
I think for comparability, we should try to get that for this as well.
Yep, no, we'll do that.
Okay.
Definitely, we'll do that.
Okay, Mary.
The people who are responsible for running the personal care program in New York City, there is, of course, the statutory requirement that 24-hour care is available under personal care, and in New York City, there are quite a number of people who, about 1,200 people, are receiving that kind of care, and there's no doubt that really drives up the hours and the cost, clearly. That's an issue, clearly. There's a very active legal community in New York City that monitors the compliance of the district, what the law allows us, and that contributes also to the number of hours in New York City. I think we can't underestimate the effect of the fact that New York City really does rely on community care to a degree that no one else in the state does, possibly no one else in the country. I don't know that. But we have far, far fewer stable population of about 30 to 35,000 Medicaid-eligible people in nursing homes, and that number has been static over the years, unlike the community-based options, which have really, really grown. And our 64 to 80-year-olds, that portion of the population has significantly moved to manage long-term care over the past years, so that what you have is a more elderly and medically complex group of individuals and behaviorally complex group of individuals receiving personal care in New York City.
Okay, hold on one second. Any questions on that side? All right, Marilyn.
Piggybacking on what Michael said about apples and oranges and what Mary said, a significant number of those hours were ordered by the DOH because of their hearing decision. So that it's not that your local social service district is giving more hours. It's that when it's gone to hearing, that many times the decisions for less hours have opened.
I've been overturned.
Particularly with 24 hours, 12 hours, 2 times 12.
Okay.
And it's also reflective of the great work New York City does in implementing Homestead and under the Civil Rights Act to keep people in the community.
Okay. Betty?
Just one question, again, because I'm not familiar with this program. The statutory requirements to provide 24-hour care, is that only downstate or is that upstate as well?
No, you can't run a program, Medicaid program is a statewide program, so it's a state law that allows someone to stay in 24-hour care. So it's a statewide mandate.
So is there comparability in percentage of people upstate as well as downstate who have 24-hour care?
Now, the vast majority of them are in New York City.
Okay. Mark?
Sure. So let me talk a little bit about the CDPAP, or Consumer-Directed Personal Assistance Program, which is powers consumers and enhances consumer choice, operated by the state with the districts. It's a fiscal intermediary model who provides the payroll functions, and the local districts monitors fiscal intermediary operations, and we monitor those districts. So it's a consumer-directed model. It's actually growing statewide, and it has a long history and tradition in New York. Must be Medicaid-eligible, must be self-directing or have a designated representative, stable medical condition, and need some or total assistance with personal care, home health, or skilled tasks. In the CDPAP model, there also is an exemption to the Nurse Practice Act, which was enacted, which allows, in the CDPAP program, non-nurses to do some nursing-type functions. It's a very important element of the program. We have 78 fiscal intermediaries statewide, about 10,000 people in the program. You see, it's a flip of the regular personal care program, and the vast majority are upstate, or rest of the state, versus New York City. The average hours per consumer annually is 1734. Before I go on to home health, any questions on
CPAP? Okay. All right, Carol.
I have a question with respect to the regulations that have come out recently.
Sure.
Are they going to be applicable to every type of provider that is going to offer CDPAP? because one of the things that's happening is other than fiscal intermediaries also offer CDPAP, and
right.
it will become part of the managed long-term care plan. So how does the regulatory frame then function as we transition?
Yeah, so which is a great question. The regulation is really an outgrowth of the of actually a long process prior to the enactment of the statute, you know, in this year's budget. We're trying to figure out how that all collides or, you know, works together on the regulations. I don't have a specific answer for you on the regulations, but that is something that's on the work plan to try to figure out, you know, what, where the, do we have to modify the regulations that were just, you know, issued. So that's a good, it's a good question, and it's on the work plan.
Okay.
I'm sorry, and I won't ask any more questions.
No.
Why don't I believe you, Mr.
I don't know. As one of the founders of New York State of the Consumer Directed Program, I fear we must keep the model pure. And what's happened in some of the counties upstate is they're using a more traditional model and calling it consumer direction. We have to have a protection that if a plan or other, any other entity operates a CDPA, CDPAP program, that it has to be pure to the plot. It cannot be a mixed model, which many of the other plans are semi-consumer-directed models.
Okay. All right. You want to conclude on the chat?
Sure. Let me just go through the home health area as well. Obviously, we have a significant home health benefit in the state, which provides services of preventive, therapeutic rehab, health guidance, and supportive nature, part-time intermediate skill services, and support services to individuals who need intermediate and skilled health care. So there's a long tradition, again, of health care, home care support in the state, and we have a very extensive home health benefit under Medicaid. You have to be CHOS, basically our certified participant, both Medicare and Medicaid, must be compliant with the CMS COPs, or conditions of participation. We have 137 CHOS in the state. We've had a moratorium for since 1994 on new entrants in the field. And at least each county is served by at least one CHA. There's a swaths of upstate that have one CHA, and but each county is served by at least one CHA. We're in, monitored by the department as well as and or an accreditation agency. This is the eligibility for home health services. Need a skilled service, nursing or therapy, usually. A physician order is required, and the assessment must demonstrate that the person's health and support needs can be safely and adequately met at home. Individuals must be self-directing, able to call for help, can be left alone, has informal or other community supports, willing, able, and available to provide care and support in addition to the service provided at the CHA. Has to be some sort of backup available. Based on, I tried to get 2010 cost report data, but it's just not available. So based on the 09 cost report data, we have unduplicated patient count in this state of 252,759 people served by CHA in 2009. New York City, you see 659, rest of state 192. The total number of RN visits, all payers, these are cost report 09 data, so we're trying to get the 10 data, but the 09 data is, you can see the RN visits and the RN visits per Medicaid. The variation there is obviously there's more Medicaid in the city than there is in the rest of the state. Total number of home health aid hours, and this is just information to present. In New York City, there's a wide use of home health aid hours, 58 million to 3 million, and the number of home health aid hours, Medicaid only, is 53 to 2 million. So there's a wide variation of the use of this benefit for a number of reasons, but and very valid reasons, but I just want to present that out as how the home health aid benefit works in this state. So basically, in conclusion, we have many long-term home and community-based programs with overlapping services. Spending is high, especially in New York City. And, you know, we hear a lot of times in the health department, I get a lot of calls from families, mostly, and consumers, that it's complex and confusing, the long-term care system. It has a great tradition, but it's really complex and confusing for a lot of families.
Okay. Are there questions or comments? Before I do that, can I just ask the people who are on the phone, if you could refrain from putting your phone on hold, unless you have terrific music. Otherwise, please put it on mute. Okay, Joanne.
Do we have any sense of how many people participating in CHA are over 120 days, and what are the characteristics of those individuals? both in terms of diagnosis and use?
Yeah, we're going to defer to Pat on that. It's coming up next, and we are trying to refine that data as well. And that's obviously a big part of the analysis. So it was initially done for the budget proposal, and then we're refining that analysis as well. But I'm going to refer that to Pat to walk us through that,
okay,
and we can
question.
Provide additional data after Pat's done.
Okay. Are there any other questions or comments? Yes, Carol.
Carol Rodat. Could you address the issue of the long-term home health care program functioning as a CHA?
Sure. In this state, we have a state law which says basically that a long-term home health care program is, by definition, state law, a certified home health agency as well, and they have to meet the conditions of participation under Medicare. So the long-term home health care program is an interesting animal in the state because it's a waiver program and it also is a program. You know, it's not just a home and community's waiver. It also has a status in state law as an actual Medicaid program. So it has that dual certification. To the federal government, the Lombardi for long-term home programs are CHAs, and they also are waivers. So it often gets confused with our federal partners, even after years of work with them on it, of what are these animals that New York has.
I just asked that question because as we move forward on defining these models, it seems to me that that's important, but would they not bump up against our certificate of need if they wanted to function as CHAs?
Well, I mean, obviously the whole certificate of need process is we're looking at as well because, you know, that's enacted in the past. In the managed care world, it must be relooked at, you know, going forward. But there is those issues. You know, what that's on the work plan is one of the issues to review as well.
Okay. All right.
Carol,
yes,
before we just we didn't get an opportunity to introduce George Gresham,
right,
who's president of 1199 SEIU, who joined us. Welcome.
Okay. Does anyone want to try to summarize what Mark said? Sort of pull all the strands together. Who's brave enough in our work group to try to do that? Okay. It is complicated, and I think there is considerable variation downstate, upstate, and there are quite a few programs, waiver programs, ordinary programs, et cetera, and we could see why it could be confusing to consumers. Okay. With that, the prerogative of the chairs, we decided it's time for a 5-minute break before we go on to Patrick. So if I could just let the people on the phone know that we will resume in 5 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Okay. Your voice is coming out loud and clear.
Great.
Now we're going to get an overview from you, I believe, on sort of what are the key cost trends in long-term care services and help us to have that context as well. So take it away.
Okay. Thank you. And I want to thank the work group for allowing me to speak today. I'm actually going to talk about two things today. I'm going to give a brief presentation on the Medicaid cost trends, and these slides are actually the same slides and context that were presented at the January 13th MRT meeting, but have been updated with 2010 data. The second part of my presentation will be on an analysis of a cohort that we believe would be the cohort of persons that would be eligible for the mandatory program, beginning on April, in April of 2012. So first I'm going to talk about the cost trends, and I'm on slide 71 right now. So these slides, for some of you that were participated in the MRT or followed the MRT process, these were some of the introductory slides we presented on January 13th. And the first slide on slide 71 really breaks down fee-for-service spending by sectors. And the important take-home part here is that, relevant to this conversation, that long-term care and waiver services continue to grow. The rate of growth over this time period is 32% for non-institutional long-term care. Slide 72 is a slide that we've, again, these are all slides we presented. And there's a couple slides and couple points I want to make on slide 72. One, the MLTC line, which I believe in the previous version of this through 2010 was around a negative 1%, and MLTC is now at a positive 2.1% over that 7-year period. You can see the CHA number at 116%, so you can see these dollars per recipient have grown substantially on the CHA. We've talked about that previously. The other numbers are very consistent with what we presented at the MRT on January 13th. Slide 73, this is really just to show you that of the growth for long-term care, the growth of 26% during that time period, that the majority of that growth is in New York City at almost 32%. That upstate, defined as counties not in New York City or not Nassau, Suffolk, or Westchester and Putnam, grew at a rate of 13%. So most of the growth is in New York City.
Patrick, I seem to remember that Nassau County had a particularly high rate of growth. Am I recalling that correctly?
That I don't recall, but we can get into that if you're interested.
Right, I would be interested.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. The slide on slide 74 is really just a simple breakdown of where the $12.7 billion, which is spent in calendar year 2010, were spent. A little over half in nursing homes, about 12% in home care, $1.55 billion, $2.15 billion in personal care, managed care at 11% at $1.4 billion. And those numbers in managed long-term care have grown, obviously, which I think the last time was at 9 or 10% in 2009. Slide 75 is really a national picture of spending, and this is 2006 data from the Kaiser Commission that we haven't updated. I'm not sure if it's been updated, but we didn't have time for this presentation. And this is the exact slide from MRT. But it shows two things of spending in terms of home care and personal care, that New York and California are far above the pack in terms of what we spend at $3.6 billion in New York and roughly the same $3.6 billion in California. Texas, Mass., and the next few states are the next highest states are nowhere near that magnitude. Additionally, should be noted that the beneficiary cost in New York is at $18,700 are obviously much higher than the other states. Mass at $10,200, California about $8,000. So some of this is benefits, some of it is population, but New York has a fairly different profile of home care and personal care spending than the other states. The last slide that was updated, and again, these are the updated slides from MRT using 2010, is slide 76, where really, this is breaking down the spending per person in New York City, downstate, and upstate, comparing the spending per person. The big difference is we've talked about before, again, it's shown here, the big differences in personal care and home care between New York City and home care, New York City and both what we're calling downstate and upstate, and personal care downstate and New York City compared to the rest of upstate. Those differences are fairly substantial compared to the other sectors in long-term care. So those are the updates of the six slides that we did on MRT on January 13th. Are there any questions on the spending slides that I've presented?
Okay. Are there any questions from the work group on the slides on cost trends? Okay, Patrick, you did such a good job that there isn't even one question for you.
Well, I imagine there will be on the next part, but that's all.
Okay. Oh, Mark.
We'll certainly entertain questions.
All right, hold on one second.
It's not
Mark.
A question, but it's an absence. We talked about the cost, but there's no quality or outcome. And I think that's equally important as the cost, because that should tell the story as well. And whatever we redesign has got to have equal importance in terms of quality and outcomes as it is driven by cost.
Right. And that is true, and I do want to make a note of that, because while later on we have, I believe, clinical acuity, which certainly is important, I don't think we see any information yet on what have we wrought. What are the outcomes for the dollars that we expend? So I do think we have to come back to that issue. Mark, unless you want to make a comment at this juncture.
No, I would just agree. We'll come back on that. I think that's worthy of a session.
Okay. Patrick.
Yes.
You want to continue?
Sure. Okay, so the second part of the presentation is an evaluation of the characteristics of a cohort of people that would be eligible for this for the mandatory enrollment. And what we've done is we've looked at previous history, claims history, using the claims data from the MMIS system and looked at previous patterns of care in persons, what services they used. We have a cohort that is based on federal fiscal year. I'm sorry, I'm on slide 78, federal fiscal year 2008-2009. Now, this cohort obviously is not the exact cohort going into the program, because obviously some people from that cohort are either not in the program anymore, or there are other people that are new to the program. But this is really for us to get a feel for magnitude, the care needs of these populations as we move forward. And when we get closer, we'll probably do this again, because we're going to have to know, obviously, when we get to April 1st, we're going to have to know the exact population that will be enrolled. So included in this is we're looking at persons who have had a long-term care expenditure for any of the services that are in that left-hand column, the long-term home health care program, child personal care, adult daycare, assisted living, private duty nursing, or SNF. We looked at all those. If they had an expenditure for four consecutive months, 120-day criteria. We excluded anyone currently during this period that was in a plan already. We excluded children under 18. We excluded the TBI and the NHTD waiver, the DD population, anyone in the CMCM program, anyone OPWDD inpatient, OASIS and OMH inpatient record, persons without any of those services were excluded, as well as hospice. So we've tried to line it up with what the MRT said, who would be enrolled going forward, and to try to get that cohort as clean as possible so we can have an understanding of what that cohort would look like. On slide 79, we'll begin to kind of the process of what we found. So in slide 79, we further restricted to for persons that were dual eligible, served personal care and home care, and were not permanently residing in a nursing facility. So that yielded a sample or a cohort of 72,335 people. Now, that on slide 79, you can see it's broken down by age. The majority, as expected, are 65 or over. As well as the spending per member per month of approximately $4,300 as for the entire cohort, slightly lower for the 18 and 64 cohort at $3,900. We further broke that down into different categories of characteristics for you to take a look at and for us to take a look at to understand, again, this population coming in. How are they similar? How are they different from what's currently in managed long-term care? We'll get into a couple of those in a second. But the first question on slide 80 was, how many were actually in the consumer-directed program in this cohort? So after all those exclusions, we're down to about 1,400 recipients, 1,378 to be exact, were in the consumer-directed program during that time period. So that percentage of people is fairly small, probably, I can't do the math that quick, but it's probably around 2%. Fairly small number of people, but certainly a policy issue of how the CDPAP group will be in this program and how their care will be delivered through plans. Slide 81 is just a quick distribution of age. And as you know, and everyone should know, that this program is a program for majority of the people are at an advanced age. I believe the managed long-term care average age, I believe Mary Beth is here, is about 79 years old. I don't think we have the average age here, but you can see the distribution is fairly similar. The peak is in the 79, 80, 81, 82. And that graph, if we're on the page 80, slide 81, the red line is the cohort that we're talking about. The black line now, it would be persons that are in managed care during calendar year. Is that 2009?
Yeah.
2009. So we did this, some comparisons to the managed long-term care current program, just to try to get an idea how this group coming in is different, how they're similar for our purposes going forward and for programmatic adjustments, et cetera. Slide 82 is a simple slide on gender. Overall, about 73% of the cohort are female, and that's very similar to what we see in managed long-term care. That number is slightly is lower for the under 64 group at about 59% female, and for over 65, around 75% female. Slide 83, and I'll keep going until someone lets me stop, or we can wait to the end either way. Slide 83 and 84, two just quick looks at the data by the first one by high-level borough sub-areas. We broke the boroughs down into some logical groupings. We could break this down further, collapse it higher, either way. This we thought was a good way to look at it. Not much difference overall, but we do see a larger number of persons in the southern Brooklyn that would be in this mandatory cohort compared to, in terms of the distribution, compared to managed long-term care. We're a slightly lower number of persons in both areas of the Bronx and parts of Manhattan and northern Manhattan. So persons in the Bronx and Manhattan have a higher percentage of are in managed long-term care already. So some differences there. Slide 84 is a quick snapshot by race ethnicity. The mandatory cohort that we're proposing is as a higher percentage of whites at 34% compared to 22% currently in managed long-term care, and a lower percentage of Hispanics, 22%. In the cohort compared to 32. Some of that, obviously, given what I just told you about the demographics in the geographic areas, are obviously related. Asians would be higher higher currently in the managed long-term care cohort at 14 compared to 7. The next couple of slides, I think, are pretty interesting in that there are ways to look at what we know at this point in time of the cohort compared to managed long-term care. The clinical acuity of eligibility cohort on page 85 uses a tool that we've used throughout the program called Clinical Risk Groups. This is a software product that we use that puts each individual into a clinical risk strata, but it also defines their chronic conditions, and that's how it builds these risk strata. It is the mechanism for those in the meeting that are in the mainstream, have any connection to the mainstream program. It's our mechanism to do risk adjustment for the plan premium. So, but underneath it, it defines chronic conditions and chronic systems or disease systems. And what you see on slide 84 and 85 is that there really isn't that much difference in terms of clinical conditions that are in this cohort compared to managed care, currently in managed long-term care. The top conditions in terms of the right columns of disease conditions of hypertension, joint muscular disorders, diabetes, osteoarthritis, et cetera, are very similar in terms of their distribution. Now, this data, you should be aware, is probably an undercount. This data is done from Medicaid data. We do not have the Medicare data yet. We are in pursuit of the Medicare data. So given that this is duals and the majority of managed long-term care is duals, we don't capture all that information, including the drug data, in this assessment of their chronic conditions. So if anything, these are going to be higher. I don't have any reason to believe that underreporting would be biased toward managed long-term care, the current fee-for-service group that would be eligible.
If we can hold just for a minute, sure. Kathy Schur had a question.
Yeah, Pat, did you develop an overall risk score for the cohort as compared to managed long-term care?
Could you repeat it, Kathy? I couldn't hear it. I'm sorry.
Sorry. Did you develop an overall risk score for the cohort compared to NLTC?
We haven't done that yet. We haven't done that yet.
Okay, Patrick, I was going to ask what we knew about dementia and prevalence of that. I only know my own plan, where we have probably a 24 to 27% prevalence of dementia, and I don't know that that's at all typical, but I think that's something that we do need to look at.
Okay. Certainly we can look at that.
Oh, Marilyn.
Patrick, I'm from
I work on a long-term MLTC program for people with disabilities, and there's always a problem when they use diagnoses to determine what cause factors are. You can have two people with 10 people with a diagnosis of MS, and some may need 2 hours of housekeeping a week, some may need 24-hour care. And so it does not reflect what I'm sure, Carol, when you talk about people who have dementia or mental health problems, you have the same issues that impact on not only the amount of care, but the type of care you're given. And so when you look at plans, see what they're doing, and you see these diseases, you know, my population of people who have diseases or disorders of the nervous system, people with MS, people with spinal cord injuries and things like that, which are a lot different than a different population.
Right. I mean, I think that's an important point that we're going to have to come back to, sort of the syndromes that you have that you don't necessarily pick up in diagnoses, whether it's incontinence or things like poor balance and risk of fall. So we're going to have to think about how we can capture that, because those things have implications for resources. Okay, Alan.
Isn't that the purpose of the assessment tool?
Right.
Diagnoses are descriptors rather than predictors. But the assessment tool, hopefully, is the tool that will...
That's capturing a broader...
Yes,
right.
I think Alan's point, your point, is the same thing. Any two patients with any given diagnosis are going to have totally different care requirements. But on a functional status measure, if it's accurate, it should be not the same appropriately.
Okay. Any other questions at this point? All right, Patrick, back to you.
So let me just say I totally agree with the comments. This was really meant to give a snapshot, and a couple. Certainly, the uniform assessment tool will help us here. In the next slide, let me just explain what this is on slide 87. On the managed long-term care side, for those that don't know, we collect a tool that's very similar. It's an assessment tool called the Semi-Annual Assessment of Members. It's based on OASIS, and it has all the ADLs and functional status and incontinence information. It does have information about cognitive status and dementia, et cetera. Certainly, in terms of rate setting, we would totally agree in the models we have for managed long-term care. On that risk adjustment side, are dominated by functional need more than clinical need. So the snapshot was really to get an idea of that difference. Slide 87, we don't have assessments, and this is the issue that Mark alluded to. This is the issue on the uniform assessment. We don't have assessments on many of the people in this cohort. So this picture here is a snapshot of 35% of the cohort of that 70,000 people. About 35%, we do have an OASIS assessment that we can look at and evaluate using the managed long-term care model, the financial model, the functional assessment score, which you see on the horizontal axis. So what we can do we can look at the OASIS data, we can measure them in the same fashion as we do managed long-term care plans, okay? So this picture shows the cohort, which is in, I believe, in red. No, I'm sorry. The cohort's in black compared to managed long-term care, which is in red, okay? So it shows some differences in terms of need. The further you are to the right on the scale is the higher the need. So there are some differences. These differences, Kathy, we don't have a score. We can compute a score of the 35% and compare it to managed long-term care to say, of this cohort, of the ones we have an assessment on, are they have a higher need than what's currently in plans? We certainly can do that, and we may have even done that. I just don't have it with me, because we as you are concerned of this group coming in, are they sicker? Does the model currently work in terms of how we pay plans? How would we adjust the model with new people coming in? All those are concerns that we all should have collectively in terms of how we pay them, pay plans, and how certainly we want to pay appropriately. So some differences here in terms of the distribution of functional assessment score. Does anybody have any questions on that?
Yes, Mary.
Yeah.
Do we have any data that's comparable in terms of what the assessment would look like for personal care or for child services or what the functional assessment scores would look like?
So this group right here, for the most part, are persons with child services where we have a valid OASIS assessment that we could link to the Medicaid data. So this is predominantly persons receiving child services. We do not have anything on personal care, and we are working with HR with some of your peers at HRA to get some of that electronic. I know you have electronic assessments that have begun recently on personal care, and we're working with your staff to try to get some of that to try to see if we can blend these. You know, if the personal care assessment is done by HRA. Can we put it in this model at some level to kind of see how the personal care group fits compared to the managed care group?
Okay. You want to go on to the next slide?
Sure. The next slide is simply now we're going away from functional need and clinical need, but what did people actually get? So this slide is actually an upside down cumulative, if that's a term I just made up. But what it says at the end is that that of the cohort, 77% have 2 hours of minimum personal care or home care in the cohort, and up to 12% get 12 hours or more. That's what that said. And you can see for different combinations of people getting personal care only or personal getting long-term home health care only get up to different percentages. So personal care only, there are 13% of the persons getting personal care only get 12 or more hours. So that's how that's interpreted. So the challenge that we have is to try to figure out collectively, both as a program and eventually into a payment model, of how to align these hours with the functional need in the graph above that. And that's what we've tried to do in managed long-term care rate setting in terms of the risk adjustment process to make sure that the hours match the need. And so that's the challenge, especially when we don't have personal care data. Last slide, in summary, mandatory group is predominantly female over the age of 65, which we expect. I don't think the socio-demographic differences are much different between the two groups. And the chronic conditions are similar. Functional assessment data are limited on what we have. Certainly, not having 2/3 of data would concern us. That we have what we have. It's good to have that, but we probably need more there. And 58% of the mandatory are receiving 4 more hours, and that's the last slide. And 12% receiving 12 hours or more.
Okay. Are there any questions for Patrick? Kathy.
Well, this is a combination for Patrick and Mark, I think. In the earlier slides, Mark, you talked about people needing child services, and one of the criteria for eligibility was that they needed to have a skilled need, I think. So they have a skilled need,
right.
and they also have need for assistance with daily living. So is a cohort of people using child services because they do have a skilled need as opposed to the personal care, are they a more complex group? And would that indicate a need for more in some of the data that Patrick showed?
Well, I think what can complicate it is, let's say you've had a very serious surgery and you have a number of other chronic conditions and you leave the hospital. So you might get a lot of hours at the outset, but you might taper off as you begin to recover and get back your functioning. So it's hard to look at this as a point in time because I think you also have to look at duration. I don't know, Mark, if you want to elaborate.
That's a great answer. I mean, I think I totally agree with that. I mean, the child benefit is linked to a skilled need. So there are home health aid hours that go with it, usually for ADL care, but technically the child benefit. So I'm not sure if we can say we may be able to say that there's people that have higher levels of need than the personal care population, and we may not be able to say that. I'm not sure. I would not feel comfortable being definitive on that.
And the other distinction that I just feel in framing is important to make is between a post-acute system and a long-term care system. So people are going to come into the CHA system who have a skilled need, and they can be like us. They're going to recover, and they're going to go back to their so-called normal life.
they're never going to go into the long-term care system. And then there's going to be some subset who do go into the long-term care system. And that comes back to your earlier question, how do you begin the enrollment process for that segment that are going to be receiving care for over 120 days and do need to be transitioned into the long-term care system?
Yeah, I don't know, Pat, if you have anything to add on that?
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Doug.
Doug Goggin-Callahan from Medicare Rates. Just looking at the chart on slide 88, I just a quick comment in sort of guiding, I guess, our thinking going forward, that we, for looking at the folks who are receiving more than 12 hours of care, just to make sure that there are adequate consumer protections so that as folks transition into managed long-term care, the managed long-term care providers don't sort of cherry-pick those individuals that are receiving lower hours of care versus, you know, the higher hour of care based on need.
Okay. Joe, did you have a question or comment?
Joe Healy. I think we're sort of beginning to circle around a fundamental issue, which is really understanding the needs of the folks who are potentially moving into managed long-term care. And some of them have very that need to be met. The issue of time, do those needs change over time? Are they really transitional or are they stable, ongoing needs? And the issue of the expenses associated with those needs. If I look, one of the, that's one of the themes that comes out across these slides. We're looking at hours. There was data several slides ago on the Medicaid PMPM spend for 8 hours. And most of those numbers for 8 hours alone are beyond what MLTCs get reimbursed PMPM for providing not only home care, but a number of other services as well. So I think this is going to be one of the major themes that we're going to have to dig into and really understand to make sure we can provide the services that people need. Because,
frankly, I can only speak for my own organization. We want to serve people, right?
And meet their needs, but it needs to be viable.
Okay. Patrick, do you know anything about the non-duals and how they compare to the duals in any of these categories?
I don't have that here. We don't have it prepared for today, but we can prepare something similar to our non-duals if you would like.
Okay.
Would that be something you're...
No, I think we do need to make sure we capture that population and look at it as well. Okay, so Patrick, I want to thank you. Michael, did you want to add anything before we move on?
Sure. I think, a framing observation is that, when you look at the infrastructure for this conversation on the long-term care side is sort of early in its development. And when you sort of look the parallel infrastructure for having this conversation on the acute care side, broadly defined to include, primary care, outpatient, and inpatient care, good acute care, good and timely acute care will prevent the need for other less desirable acute care. But the same is not true on the long-term care side. Good and timely long-term care services will also prevent undesirable acute care. But they won't prevent the need for other long-term care services. So I think that there is oftentimes in the absence of another framework, we just sort of pull the acute care framework over. But there are some ways in which it doesn't translate.
Joe.
But what good long-term care does do is actually prevent the continued deterioration of health and the worsening of chronic conditions. It can stabilize, preserve quality of life, extend people's lives. So there's value that comes in a different form that doesn't translate into the acute care.
I certainly wasn't saying that there wasn't value. There obviously is great value. I think that I apologize if that wasn't clear. There is obviously tremendous value in the body of work that the United Hospital Fund has done over time is true to that. But I think in these data analyses,
there is the implicit premise that if you drill down enough on the utilization and you get smarter about the utilization, you can prevent some of the utilization. And that is a good thing in many ways, desirable. It's probably realizable, but it's not necessarily realizable in exactly the same way that we know it is on the acute care side. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, Patrick, I want to thank you again. And let me ask the work group if you would be willing to go on and have our last speaker, Jim, do his presentation, which we thought we could conclude by 1 o'clock and then have lunch at 1. Or are you so famished that concentration will not be possible? So let me just get a sense of the group. If you're willing to forge ahead till 1 p.m., all right. I knew that we had a tough group here. All right, Jim.
Thank you, Carol. No pressure. I'll talk while Mark is looking at my slide. I'm Jim Breer from Mathematics Policy Research, and I've been working with the New York State Department of Health since late last year with funding from the New York State Health Foundation to help them think through dual eligible issues and how to design programs for dual eligibles, based in large measure on what we've learned over the years from what other states have done in terms of building programs for dual eligibles and non-duals in various disabled eligibility categories. We did a report most recently for the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, which is a commission that advises Congress on Medicare issues. And they've gotten much more interested in dual eligible. So we did telephone interviews with about 9 states and site visits to New Mexico and Massachusetts and North Carolina. So a lot of what I'm going to be talking about in terms of putting New York into that perspective of what other states are doing is it builds on that that work we've done before, but what I thought would be most helpful for you is to try and fit what you're doing here in New York into the context of what other states have done, talk a little bit about the lessons that there may be from that other state experience that would be useful for New York. And then I've got some other slides that I won't go through. I'll just tell you they're there, and you can look at them at your leisure. But really, what I've done on this first slide here is look at the building blocks that New York has. And what I'm doing here primarily is looking at the level of capitated managed care plans of various kinds. If the goal is to end up with care that is fully integrated and fully coordinated for beneficiaries, then you need all of the different pieces come together. You need the acute care pieces, you need the long-term care pieces, you need the Medicaid pieces, and if they're just Medicaid, that's, you know, that's all you need, but if they're dual eligibles, you need the Medicare pieces as well. So New York has really a lot of the building blocks for all of that. They're just not assembled at this point. And I've listed on the slides there the various building blocks that do exist that you're all more familiar with, really, than I am. And if you look at other states, most of them are not as far along in having these existing building blocks and experience with them as New York is. The states that are furthest along really are Arizona and Minnesota, and they have very unusual histories that explain why they were able to put more of the pieces together. But even Arizona is missing some pieces. Behavioral health is carved out to some extent. Minnesota is missing some pieces. They don't have as robust a program for the under 65 duals as they do for the over 65. So all states are facing the same kind of challenges that you are. And what we're trying to do with our work with the Department of Health and in a report for the foundation that is due in August is try and get from you what you think would be most useful to learn from these other states. So part of what I'm hoping to do today is get some of your thoughts on that. So the potential goals could be to improve coordination and integration cost effectiveness just for Medicaid-only beneficiaries, and that's a daunting task, but less daunting than bringing in the Medicare piece. And the second bullet is basically the Medicare piece, and Valencia has talked about what's going on there. The real challenges for New York, it seems to me, just as an outsider looking in, is expanding coverage of the Medicaid managed long-term care plan outside of the New York area, up into the upstate area where there are some of those plans operating, but the networks and the experiences and the stakeholder relationships are not as well developed there. An alternative to that, or a complement to that, is in the next bullet, and that would be adding long-term care benefits to the mainstream Medicaid plans. And you're on the way to do that with the personal care assistance and the nursing facility services being added to that. Then moving to the coordinating and integrating care for dual eligibles, there are substantial obstacles that New York faces and every other state does as well. One major one is enrollment growth. Can't mandate enrollment for Medicare services. So that's a significant problem. The new Office for Coordinated Medicare and Medicaid Services in Washington, in CMS, which is headed by a former colleague, is working on options that might ease up on that initial assignment for the opt-out. There are major financing obstacles. Most of the things you would do on the Medicaid side is use the inpatient hospital and emergency room use cost Medicaid money and save money for Medicare. So there has to be a way for states to share in those Medicare savings. And the duals office in CMS is working on that as well. Then there are all sorts of administrative obstacles because each program is in its own silo, with its own history, has administrative requirements that cover the same topic, but they're just different for historical reasons. And Melanie has tried to put all of the Medicare and Medicaid people in one room who are responsible for this set of obstacles, and hoping not to let them out until they come up with a way of making that a bit more coordinated. Moving to the program design challenges, and these are things that other states have had experience with as well. They're really very, very major differences. Care needs, costs, or dual eligibles who are over 65. And they're dual eligibles basically just because they're old and they're poor, not because they're especially sick. Whereas the under 65 duals are dual eligibles because they have various and very diverse serious chronic illnesses, coexisting behavioral health problems, physical disabilities, and a whole range of very complex care needs. And they're served by different groups of providers. Their concerns are very different, and they have to be addressed in a much more I think, discrete way. And all states have really struggled with designing programs for the over and under 65 duals that fit with the needs of those two different populations. The Medicaid-only SSI population is really very similar to the under 65 duals in terms of their care needs and their characteristics, because they're on Medicaid because they have disabilities and chronic illnesses, much as duals are on Medicare for that reason. So there's that experience to build on, but there still is the challenge of adding the long-term care piece, all of the things that Mark Kissinger talked about. It's very different. That's very different. Managing that is very different from managing acute care services. So that's clearly a challenge. A huge challenge, which I know is part of another work group's task, is coordinating physical and behavioral health services. The under 65 duals, at least 40% of them have very serious mental health and substance abuse
kinds of problems. The over 65 population has mostly dementia and Alzheimer's, but there are people with schizophrenia and serious mental illnesses as well. And the last point I would make on the design challenges is just it's impossible to overstate how you just really need to consult with a very wide and diverse group of stakeholders, because for a lot of people, you know, their health care and the associated supportive services are, you know, a major, major part of their lives and a major concern with their lives, and they have a lot of questions, many of which you've raised here, that really need to be thought through. And our experience in looking at states that were successful and not successful in developing coordinated care programs for our MedPAC project really drove that home. There were states that didn't do an adequate job of consultation, and their programs were never implemented, or if they were implemented, they were not successful. So that's very, very, very important. The examples from other states I've just listed there, there are states that do Medicaid-managed long-term care like you do in the managed long-term care programs. There are states that have mandatory enrollment of Medicaid-only beneficiaries, as you do. There are fee-for-service-based care management programs in North Carolina and Oklahoma and Vermont. A lot of states rely on Medicare Advantage special needs plans. You can see them there. A lot of states have PACE programs. The enrollment nationwide is very low. It's only a little over 20,000. New York probably has the most of any state. So there are models and examples from all of those other states. The lessons I would draw from that are obvious one, focus on the high-cost, high-need populations, because that's where better coordination, integration, management of care can have the biggest payoff, both in terms of cost and, if it's done well, in terms of quality. Starting with Medicaid-only managed care is maybe easier because you can build the health plan capacity, provider networks, stakeholder relationships, financing, track record, et cetera, without the additional complications of dealing with Medicare. Enrollment can be mandatory for Medicaid beneficiaries, so you can get the scale you need to run a managed care program. And most of the financing and administrative requirements are entirely within state control. Integrating Medicare services for duals is really the gold standard, and I know that's where New York and a lot of other states that have gotten these dual demo contracts are going. But there are challenges, but there is now sort of an opportunity for a learning collaborative, a learning network among all of the states that are working on this. CMS is pulling together technical assistance and learning collaborative kinds of opportunities for states to do that. So that's, I think, very promising. A couple things for further information. There's a site for the MedPAC report that I mentioned that we did for them. MedPAC's last two reports to Congress in June of 2011-2010 both have very good chapters on duals. The June 2010 report has linked data for Medicare and Medicaid services and costs for all 9 million dual eligibles at the individual level, so you can see how much they're getting from each program. You can see how it varies with diagnoses and coexisting conditions and people in nursing facilities as opposed to people in the community. So it's a good way of getting some insights at the national level. And there's underlying state-by-state data, which I'm trying to figure out how to get out to the world as well. And then I mentioned the report that we're doing in August. There are a bunch of other slides there that I'm not going to go through. They're reasonably self-explanatory, but there are several slides there on enrollment in managed care in New York, in various forms of managed care by Medicaid-only beneficiaries and by dual eligibles. There's data on national enrollment of dual eligibles in Medicaid and Medicare managed care programs. There's background information on the current national special needs plan marketplace and how that's evolved over time. There's some information on the impact of various aspects of healthcare reform on special needs plans and dual eligibles and care coordination options. There are there's a slide there on the states among these 15 states that got dual eligible demonstration grants that are using special needs plans or thinking about it. There are a couple of slides there that give more detail on the Massachusetts and the New Mexico experience with special needs plans, because that is similar, I think, in many respects to some of the things that you're looking on at in New York. And then there's some slides right at the end that lay out a lot of the opportunities from managed long-term care in terms of both cost and efficiency and quality of care benefits, but there are a lot of challenges as well, which are laid out in those slides, and I'd be happy to go over any of those as any detail people would like.
Okay. Jim, thank you very much for synthesizing a considerable amount of material. I happen to have read Jim's full report, so he really has taken just an enormous amount of information and digested it for us. But I would say, having read your report, the challenges are mighty on a number of fronts here. Okay, any questions at this point? Yes, Alan.
Jim, when you look at the data from other states, New York, on the slide that was presented earlier, New York spends much more.
Right.
Do we get much more in outcome, or there's discernible differences in outcome? For example, is our nursing home admit rate lower, hospitalization rate lower? Are the metrics that would justify the added expense?
The short answer is the data you would like are not there, but it is gettable. And the thing that I think is sort of most important for dual eligibles in particular is trying to get better data on avoidable hospitalization, because that's where the divergence between Medicare and Medicaid is greatest, and I think it especially occurs in nursing home settings, where you have people in nursing homes who could have a lot of their needs taken care of in nursing homes, and would not have to go into a hospital for care of pressure ulcers, or they have a problem in the middle of the night and there's not a doctor there, and so they go to the emergency room. So you can measure avoidable hospitalizations and avoidable readmissions from nursing home settings and from other settings from this linked Medicare and Medicaid data that I talked about. And there are some studies that CMS has commissioned on that, and there are more of these kinds of things that are doable with that linked data, which is a resource that's just recently become available. So there's the potential for more, but not very much there now.
Okay, Michael?
This is Michael Berman speaking. That exchange confused me.
Okay.
I think I heard a question about the state-by-state comparisons of Medicaid spending on long-term care services in the previous presentation, right? So I think the answer should lead with that comparison puts New York side-by-side with states that don't cover long-term care in their Medicaid programs to the same degree that New York does. So I think that that's the headline answer, and if that's not a not to dismiss the next level of the conversation entirely, because it's an important one, and we need to get better outcomes and better metrics for outcomes for our dollars in. But if the existence of home-based community long-term care services in New York put side by side with the absence of those services in other states' Medicaid programs is not prima facie evidence of better outcomes. I don't know what is.
Okay. Jim, I was going to ask you, to what extent are the states that are pursuing managed long-term care models requiring the providers or / plans to be Medicare special needs plans?
They did that in New Mexico, They have done that in Minnesota and several other states. In Texas, they're moving in that direction. Arizona has moved pretty far in that direction. And I think the choice or the decision for states is, number one, is this a marketplace where we think we can attract a reasonable number of Medicare Advantage special needs plans that would have the capability and the interest of contracting with the state to cover Medicaid long-term care services as well. So that's kind of the threshold question. Can we get plans who are able to do that? Another way of coming at it, if you're a state like, Oregon, for example, that has a pretty robust Medicaid-managed care program and includes long-term care services in it, but doesn't necessarily want to contract with special needs plans and might prefer to see their own plans, their Medicaid plans, become Medicare plans. And a lot of that happened, actually, back in 2006 when special needs plans were first authorized. A lot of Medicaid-only plans became Medicare special needs plans as well and added that Medicare capability. So it's possible to do, and it's somewhat easier to do now that there are more states that have had experience going both ways, starting on the Medicare side and adding Medicaid, or starting on the Medicaid side and adding Medicare.
Okay. Jim.
Yeah, I think we just want to be careful. We have to be not to think about making our decisions in reference to the situation that has prevailed. I mean, with the new Duell's office, clearly there's an unknown range of possibilities in front of us. And, I think, again, we have the grant in place, which is a planning grant, and I think the decision making on the design of the Duell strategy is something that this work group ought to get too concerned about, other than to anticipate that Duell's integration is in our future. But I think that's going to involve policy making from 2012 and beyond as we get a better understanding of what the feds are prepared to embrace as a Duell an integration strategy.
Okay, that's a good cautionary note in terms of scope creep and making sure that we try to avoid that to the fullest extent that we can. All right, on that note, I think we're going to break for lunch, and I'd like to resume at 1:15. So thank you, Jim, for joining us today. p.m. All right.
This call will resume at 1:15 p.m.
All right.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.